Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show. Welcome to History 605. Today on this episode, we have a discussion with Corey Christensen. Corey is currently the registrar at the Museum of the South Dakota State Historical Society. She earned her BA in History and English from the University of South Dakota and her Master's in Museum Studies from the University of Oklahoma. She has in the past volunteered time at the Air and Space Museum at Ellsworth Air Force Base and worked at Rapid City's Journey Museum, where she co-designed the exhibit about the Black Hills Flood of 1972 at the Journey, which was the topic of a previous History 605, on Season 2, Episode 3, where we talked to Corey about that exhibit of the Black Hills Flood. Corey, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I wanted to have you back because you have an article that's appeared in the fall edition, which would be Volume 54-3 of South Dakota History, about a man who never became famous, yet certainly was historic. In fact, the article is taking up the entire issue of the journal, and it opens up what I think is a rich vein of historical understanding for this young man. He goes from a farm boy near Sisson to one of the 20th century's most storied battlefields and comes home and deals with that. And so today we'll be talking about Alfred Dahlin and how that opens up a window into that experience. Corey, I wonder if you could talk about how did we come across this fellow? What was the first inkling that Alfred Dahlin existed?
So in 2022, the museum, the State Museum, got a phone call from a gentleman by the name of Cody Stanley. And Cody is the nephew of Alfred Dahlin. Cody said, "I have a fully intact World War I uniform and all of the accoutrements that go with it. And we were wondering if we could donate it to the museum." And, you know, generally speaking, fully intact uniforms include helmet, boots, everything. And my first thought was, it's not fully intact. He probably doesn't have the boots, because usually boots were worn out to the extent of falling apart and thrown out after being worn in World War I. But he had the boots. He had all the stuff. And he brought it down to us and we accepted it. And I was lucky enough to be able to go through all of the artifacts. And I went, I really want to do more research into Alfred. And it just kind of took off from there, to be honest with you.
Okay. Well, and to be clear, I think I mispronounced his name. So it's pronounced Dahlin.
I'm going to go with yes.
Okay. So Alfred Dahlin, also known as Fred, right?
Fred to his family and his friends. I've been given permission to refer to him as Fred. So if I say Fred, that's who I'm talking about.
Sure.
But since one of the other nephews, great nephews, has already told me that I should come to family reunions at this point, feel like I'm allowed to say Fred.
Okay. Well, we'll get into that in a little bit. But before we do that, let's kind of itemize all the things in a soldier's uniform that, you can go down a list of the things that this donation included from the Dahlin family.
So the original donation, because we've gotten a couple of donations since 2022, all surrounding Fred.
Okay.
The original donation had his full uniform, It had an overcoat. It had his helmet and his boots. It had a Bible. It had a bunch of photographs that Fred had collected in his years after the war. Mm. It had maps and books that Fred had collected after the war. Mm. And then it had a couple of letters that Fred had sent home. And I say a couple because, again, there were multiple donations within the past 2 years.
So I think I walked into the curated area a couple of days maybe after this kind of initial donation occurred. Mm-hmm. And I was astounded at the maps. I remember looking at those and why did Fred have these maps?
We don't have a true answer, but my best historical background guess is that because Fred was wounded, he wanted to make sure he knew exactly what happened to him. And so in the aftermath of coming back from the war and going back to the farm outside of Sisseton, he wanted to make sure he knew exactly what happened to him. And so he started collecting photographs and maps of the areas he served in order to better understand exactly what happened.
He was in, I alluded to it, one of the 20th century's biggest battles, and certainly for the American participation in World War I, he winds up kind of being in the first few days of that offensive. So there's a lot written about the Meuse-Argonne engagements. He may have, after the war, realized he was a part of something very historic.
That's very possible. He was part of the 91st Division. He was part of the 362nd Infantry. So a lot of South Dakota service stems from the National Guard in World War I. Mm-hmm. A lot of them went along with the 147th. Fred was one of the few South Dakotans who actually did not serve with the National Guard during World War I. So he was sent into the 91st Division, which was commonly known as the Wild West Division, because a lot of their soldiers came from Montana and Wyoming. And so Fred ended up being put in a division of a lot of
Wild Westerners.
and it's even talked about, they had their own battle cries going into battles just because of who they were and where they came from.
And this division was created for the war. I think as the United States Army is gearing up for this, your article goes through the ramp up to the war, the Zimmermann telegram, which was Germany's diplomatic effort to plan for the eventuality of America entering the war and trying to get a ally on our southern flank, and telegraphing the Mexican government and saying, hey, if you join in the war,
we'll give you Texas.
We'll give you Texas back. And of course, the British, being the sneaky dudes that they are, have intercepted this and decrypted it. And they release this to the public. And of course, the American people go, I don't think so. And a month later, we declare war. It's a part of the ramp up and caught up in unrestricted submarine warfare and so forth. And so your article kind of sets the scene for America's entry into the war by a president who had campaigned on staying out of the war.
The article, I really wanted it to make sure people understood what was happening to Fred even before he got sent to war.
Yeah.
Because he was so young. And so I really wanted the article to go, okay, this was Fred's childhood. This is the war that was ramping up into America's entry. And then they came together.
Right.
So we kind of tried to tie the two stories together.
Yeah, I think the article does a very nice job of talking about this kind of national politics down to the very personal experiences of him, his religious confirmation, as all these kind of scrapbook kind of things that people collect in their lives of the big deals in their personal lives, letters and so forth that he had with his sister and his family back home while he was in France. But then after the war as well, I think, you do get a picture of his boyhood as setting out on his own with his brothers to farm and manage the family land. And then the war comes along and he is drafted, and his situation is kind of atypical of the typical South Dakotan who might have gone out with South Dakota's Guard unit.
Right.
And so, yeah, he winds up in this other division and winds up in the thick of things. So those maps then kind of become his way of dealing with understanding his, in a metaphorical way, in a literal way, the topography of his experiences. And that those maps and all of those stuff are interesting. Of course, the other thing that you spent a lot of time on is Fred's boots. So talk to us about how your training as at Oklahoma and since has allowed you to kind of take those boots as an artifact and interpret their meaning.
As a volunteer at the Air and Space Museum, we received a World War I uniform this is pre-Air Force. This is Army Air Force.
Yeah.
We received their World War I uniform. It had no boots attached to it. And I was digging and I was doing research and I was looking for maybe there's a way we can find someone who would like to loan us a pair of boots. And the general consensus was that World War I soldiers, when they came home, they would continue to wear those boots because they were obviously useful in the trenches. They have nails in the bottom of the soles. But they were useful for walking around every day. They were heavy duty. They could last a while. And so the general consensus was those boots would get worn out to the point where they wouldn't be saved anymore after a certain point. And so when the donation came in, when Cody Stanley brought us the donation and the boots were right there, I had a little bit of a, I never thought I would be able to hold a pair of World War I boots. And so I did spend a lot of time on them. And the boots are fascinating because they are exactly what all of the research said that they would be. They have the hobnails. They have the metal along the heel. They are worn down. You can see exactly, especially after Fred was injured, the way he walked, it causes wear on the part of the shoe that he would have had to lean on more. Mm-hmm. And you can see that on the boots. Mm-hmm. And so I did spend a lot of time on them because they were so fascinating to me.
Yeah.
And they're in really good shape.
Do you think then he didn't wear them after the war very much? Or maybe as he got older, he just kind of set them aside?
I think he probably did after the war, just from the wear of the one edge of the boot. I think he wore them after the war. But in the scheme of things, he might have also packed them away. He might have also just went, we don't have confirmation that he ever wore his uniform again after the war. He would have been allowed to. And if he had participated in like Legion parades because he was part of the Legion, then maybe he did. But we don't have any confirmation that he participated in any of those things. So it's just one of those, the part that I have a problem with, or not a problem, but like a struggle with Fred's life is that he went home after the war. He healed. And then very little was known about him, or very little was shared with me about him after a certain point. And that's not due to any reason. It's just that Fred kind of, he wasn't the most social person in the world. He didn't always go out and do things. And so I think there are assumptions I can make and there are guesses I can make, but I can't confirm those guesses.
Well, let's kind of walk through his World War I experiences then. So he goes out for basic training, trains up with his infantry.
Yep. He was in Fort Lewis.
Fort Lewis, Washington.
He was in Fort Lewis and then was sent to Camp, I guess it was Camp Lewis at the time. Camp Lewis, then Camp Merritt, and then...
In New Jersey.
And then he was sent, he landed in England.
Well, don't skip over the boat ride. I think that's a key thing of his experience. So he gets on a converted...
He gets on a converted...
Cruise ship. right?
Cruise ship called the Empress of Russia.
Okay.
And he was sent overseas, and we have a single letter from his time on the ship. It says somewhere in the ocean. That's the location.
It's a big place.
Yeah. And he sent the letter, and then he lands in England, and then he goes to France. Now, his training was not up to speed at that point. So then they spent a couple of months training more, July, August time frame. They spent training in England and France. And then and I'm going to butcher French names just so you know.
Okay.
The St. Mihail Salient happens.
Yes, which is a salient is not a physical place necessarily. It's a geometric expression of a point. So
right.
The salient is something that is vulnerable because you can be enveloped by the enemy. And so this big battle at St. Mihail is a town, which is a geographic place. Yeah.
The general in charge of the whole army in France,
Pershing.
Thank you. Pershing went, he's talking to the French commanders, and he's like, I want to take St. Mihail back.
Mm-hmm.
And the French commanders are like, we don't want you to do that. And Pershing's like, I don't care what you want. We're going to do it. That's essentially how the conversation went. I've read multiple sources that were like, the French said no, and Pershing said yes, and it happened.
Yeah. Well, it's a part of a bigger political fight about the French wanted to put U.S. units under French command.
Yes.
Which isn't a military decision. It's a political one. And at Pershing's level and above, it would have been detrimental to the United States' ability at the peace talks to have its soldiers fighting under French generals or British generals.
So Fred and his 362nd Infantry Regiment got put on call to be part of this battle. And so they spent a night listening to the battle happen, always ready to go. But that was essentially Fred's first experience in the actual war, was this battle. Now, Americans took that battle handily. The Germans were actually retreating by the time the Americans got there. And so, but the overall experience was the Americans came in, they captured a whole bunch of Germans, they did their jobs, and they did it well. And so it kind of made the idea of having American troops in France such a good idea, right? So it's we made the right choice, the Americans are here, the positive. And then Fred moved, and he moved, and they moved, and they moved, and they just kind of bounced around France, and we can track it. We can track their movements. And then on the 27th of September, they got involved in the battle at Epinonville. And they had been continuing to fight. And they've gained and lost that town so many times. It's like four times or five times that they attempted to take the town, and they finally did. So they're exhausted by the end of the night on the 28th. And then on the 29th, they were ordered to take the small town of Guinée.
Right.
And it is a picturesque, beautiful town. I've seen pictures of it. Stereotypical French town. And it is not a great area. They were supposed to take it from the Germans, but the Germans had the high ground. And so immediately they were walking into what would become a horrible battle. They were ordered to launch at 5 a.m. on the 29th of September. It, of course, had rained the whole night. So they're cold, they're wet, they're muddy. And they attacked twice, two different orders throughout the morning, and they failed both times. And then in the afternoon, there was one more attack ordered. And they did it, but not without huge injuries and huge casualties throughout the whole of the 362nd. And it was in that third one that Fred was wounded. Fred had been hit with shrapnel, and it shattered both bones in his left arm and completely, like, when he describes it in his letter to his sister, it was, I'm numb. I can't feel anything. My arm's broken. Doctors don't know what's going to happen. And to Slater Sabo and I, Slater's the editor, that sounded a lot like he had nerve damage in his hand and his arm because of the shrapnel, which would not surprise me at all. So Fred and the 362nd took Genet, and then they were ordered to retreat the same day.
So they're not replaced by another division who holds their position. They just give it back.
They were ordered to retreat. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it only comes out later that the general in charge made the order, and then he went, never mind, I don't want you to do this. But when he went, never mind, it was too late, and they had already launched.
Yeah.
It's a hard thing.
Yeah.
So from there, Fred goes to, and this is where it's getting kind of hard to trace Fred. So up until the battle, we can trace him really easily because we can track where the 362nd went, and Fred would have been with them the whole time.
Right.
I didn't even mention the fact that Fred's infantry was in a horrific train crash either.
Oh, right.
But Fred
I
glossed over that one.
Well, yeah, there's some interesting information that you pull together out of the newspapers and so forth and put together that he would have probably would
he
have
would not have been there.
Right.
But he
would have known people who were
would have known people who would have been.
Yeah.
So Fred, this is where, but after the Battle of Genet, this is where it gets interesting because Fred went to what we think was Chepi Woods Field Hospital. But we can't confirm that. That's the only reason why I'm saying he went there. It's because that's the closest hospital they had, Field Hospital. And then he would have been sent to a larger, more steady hospital. And it was nearby, but he would have had to travel quite a ways to get there.
Yeah.
And then they would have shipped him home. So they would have taken him back to England. And he would have come back to the United States.
Which necessitates his departure from his unit.
Right.
Right. So he gets back to the United States months before the bulk of his unit does, right?
So he got back to the United States January 1st.
Okay.
So he would have been in England. He would have been in France and or England in hospitals when the armistice happened. He would have gotten back about 3 to 5 months before any of his infantry regiment got back.
But then they probably are mustered out of service and get back home long before he does. That was the other thing in reading the article, is that he can go on furlough from his convalescent hospital in Iowa up to visit family and friends in Sisseton. But he's got to go back. That to me would, I think, make his, would just plummet his morale to go back and forth for therapy that all they're doing is massaging his left arm. I mean, give me a break.
so here comes another educated guess of what happened to Fred.
Yeah.
So Fred's injury was so bad that he had two options. He could have gone, and there were two hospitals they could have sent him to. They could have sent him to Fort Snelling.
Oh.
Or they could have sent him to Camp Dodge. However, Camp Dodge and Fort Des Moines had been well known at this point for their orthopedic surgeries for fractures and bones. Had Fred gone to Fort Snelling, there is a very high likelihood that he would have lost his arm.
It just would have amputated. Yeah.
Yep. He's at Camp Dodge and Fort Des Moines. Mm-hmm. Now we're digging into the next set of donations.
Oh, so there's more to the story.
So,
maybe.
early 2024, early this year, rolls around, and Curtis Dillon, who is Fred's nephew, who had met Fred, he connects me with the other side of the family. So Fred had an older sister named Kate, and Kate married a man by the name of Sundry Swinemson, and Kate had kids and they had kids. And so there's a whole Swinemson side of the family. And he connected me to one of the Swinemson descendants, Cal. And Cal's last name is Christensen, of no relation. Okay.
E-N or O-N?
His is E-N.
Okay, so then there's no relation.
No relation. It's T-E-N-S-E-N. It's not I-A-N-S-O-N like
okay.
mine.
Okay.
So Cal calls me and he goes, "I'm so excited you're writing this article. I can't wait for it to come out. I have Fred's purple heart."
Wow.
And I was like, in my head, I'm going, "Please give it to the museum." What I said to him was, "Can I see a picture?" Because all I wanted at this point. So we are a year and a half into my research. The article has been fully written at this point.
Oh, okay.
Like fully written to the extent of Slater, the managing editor of press, and I are going back and forth talking about, can we add this? Do we need more detail here? What are we missing here? That sort of thing. And I went, "Can you send me a picture?" And Cal goes, "Do you want it for the collection?" And I was like, "Yes, please."
Yeah.
So Cal sets up a time to bring it out to Pier, because he's West River. He brings it out to Pier. And then he's telling me, he goes, "I'm heading to Sisseton. I'm going to go look at the family farm. I don't think I'm going to find anything, but if I do, I'll let you know." And I said, "Great." Like, I don't think he's going to find anything either, you know, because what I had heard was the farm had been gone through so many times. I get a call Sunday night, and of course I'm not at work. And so it's Cal, and he leaves me a message and he goes, "Hey, I found 30 letters Fred had written Kate during training, being in France, and when he's in the hospital afterwards.
Wow.
I'm going to bring them to you on my way back to West River."
Okay.
And so I called Slater and I was like, "You're never going to believe this." And he goes,
"Hold the presses." Corey,
he goes, "Corey, your article is so long." And I'm like, "Yeah, but what if there's something in there?" And Slater's like, "No, I know. You're definitely going to need to write more." And I was like, "Okay." So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just we'll take a little quick aside here. That's the editorial aspect of producing one of these articles, is the arbitrary word count.
Yes.
And the fighting to keep an article to fit within the standard frame of a journal. But in this case, it no longer would. And so what was the decision that Slater and the team made at the journal?
So Slater and the team, Deidre, who is the director of the press arm of the State Historical Society, and Slater and I had a conversation, and I went, "Look, this story," and this was before the letters even came in. I said, "Look, this story is huge." And Slater went, "Why don't you do the full journal? And it has to be 24,000 words." And I was like, "Okay, that's easily doable for how much information I have right now."
Yeah.
And so then when I called Slater and I told him about the Purple Heart and I told him about the letters, he said, "We'll write as much as you can, and then we'll edit it down." He actually came out and he helped me go through the letters and went, "Right, this part I think is important. This part I think is important." And so Slater was really hands-on about what are we adding at this point, because we knew the story and we were looking for ways to, you know, I can make educated assumptions and I can make guesses, but the letters we got actually reiterated that my assumptions were correct. And so we used them to put into the article, "Hey, this is actually what happened from Fred's own words."
Right, right. Well, and that's the thing, is it is part of the historical craft. You, if you don't know, but you're assuming some things, you need to tell the reader that, "Hey, this is my assumption based on the evidence I have. But then when you have the man's own words, you can judiciously quote him, not to reproduce every word in every letter, but you can pick out the things that are representative of the things he's telling his sister at the time they're happening to him. So that just opened up a whole new level of historical accuracy that you otherwise would be taking some guesses at, right?
And I feel like I got to know Fred so much better after I got those letters.
Sure.
Because I could feel his despair of being at the hospital and Camp Dodge and Fort Des Moines. Like, he was so upset he wasn't at home. He was so worried about what was going to happen to his hand.
Yeah.
He was so worried about what's going on with his family. And he just wanted to be home.
Yeah. Well, there's a level of boredom that only that the typical human being can only sustain so much for such a duration. And then when it's in the back of your mind that you might lose your hand after all of this, right? I mean, they could have taken it off in France. They could have just, you know, when he's half out of his wits due to the pain and the immediacy of the battle and all the experiences, but they don't. So he's got fairly fortunate all along the way to be placed under the care of physicians that are at least giving him a chance, or giving his arm and his hand a chance to continue on. So, well, and how, he's a little bit older. He's not the typical 18-year-old when he's drafted. How old is he? He's drafted at the age of 25 or so?
He was drafted at the age of 24. Shortly before his 25th birthday. So he was a little bit older. He had worked on the farm his whole life. So this is very different for him.
So then he finally gets separated out and goes home to Sisseton. And what's the post-army life like for Fred?
He goes back to the farm. He becomes part of the American Legion in Sisseton.
Which is a new organization at the time.
It is a new organization.
The World War I veterans found the American Legion, and it looks like he's one of the charter members in this.
Yeah, it was right after it was chartered. He was documented in membership lists as early as October 17th, and the Legion was chartered the 28th of August. So it was real early.
Okay.
He went to the South Dakota State College of Agriculture and Mechanics, which is known as now
SDSU. Yep.
And I actually contacted SDSU and they gave me their information on Fred.
Okay.
Did
you get his grade? By information, what does that mean?
Well, they said he was there. They said he participated.
He was an enrolled student.
He was an enrolled student. He was one of many disabled veterans who actually attended SDSU after the war. It helped the transition back into society, I think. And then we have newspaper blurbs of like him coming home for Easter and him coming home for, you know, different visits and that sort of thing. And then we can like track his compensation. So we have his compensation application. He joined the 362nd Infantry Association. He was one of 18 representatives from South Dakota when he was sent to the 6th Annual American Legion Convention. It was held in St. Paul, Minnesota that year.
So that's a national convention?
It is a national convention. And they read a letter from Pershing at that convention.
Right. I got a kick out of that, how Pershing wishes he could be there, but duty calls and he can't come. But he
right. And then we kind of lose track of Fred a little bit, and not in a bad way, but some newspapers aren't digitized yet, right? And access to newspapers is hard in person because they might have fallen apart. He's listed in every census after every U.S. census after the war. He returned to the family farm and raised cattle with his brother Albert and Ben. He was affected by the Dust Bowl. They were part of the Agricultural Adjustment Act, also known as the Farm Relief Act. There's a likelihood that Fred's family would have gotten money for their cattle from the federal government at some point in 33 or 34.
Yeah, okay. So that was Congress's attempt to kind of deal with the economic hardship of the Depression and the Dust Bowl and the banking crisis. So, yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
But $250,000 were paid to the farmers in Roberts County.
Okay.
So I'm guessing Fred's family would have gotten a little bit of that money. And then Fred registered for the draft again in 1942.
That's astonishing. The Japanese attack Pearl Harbor in December 41. The draft had existed I think during the 30s and 40s, there was a draft. It was just minimally exercised. But then and by January of 42, you know, it's full bore.
Well, it was one of those things where it was America wasn't going to get involved until something happened and America got involved.
Right.
Right. So the card that he filled out was meant for men born on or after April 28th, 1877, and on or before February 16th, 1897. And if I remember correctly, Fred was born in 96. And it did not ask for any reasons for exemption, although it probably should have. Fred's draft card makes no reference to service. It makes no reference to his injury. And it barely mentions the fact that he's a farmer in South Dakota. But Fred would have been 48 years old when he filled out that draft card.
Well, I imagine there's a legal obligation to do so. But then a fairly low prospect of him actually being drafted due to all those reasons you just listed that he served in World War I.
I think because of the manpower pool that America had to go off of originally, I think this was a general if something really bad happens, this is our next group of people we'll pull from.
Yeah, our last group of people.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay. And then I think this, of course, has a sad ending.
It does. It does. And the best way I can say it is that Fred took his own life in 1951. He had had a medical emergency in 1950, and his brother Ben had moved him into a little cottage on the family land. And then he took his own life in 51.
Yeah. What was the nature of the medical emergency in 1950?
The general consensus was that it was a heart attack. He was sent up to the VA hospital in North Dakota. We've never been able to contact or get information from the VA hospital, mostly because Fred doesn't have a social security number.
All right. Well, no, wait a minute. Why not? I mean, social security starts in 1934 or 5 time frame.
Right, but if you were born before that, you could apply to get one, but I don't think he ever applied to get one.
Okay. Well, that says something right there, doesn't it? Maybe. You can assume that he didn't. Maybe he thought, I have my veterans benefits. I don't.
He had his military number. He had his military number, so.
Where are his dog tags? Is this part of the set that was donated?
Yes, we have his dog tags.
Both of them?
Okay. Both of them.
Okay.
And then Fred was buried in Sisseton at the cemetery. He has a military headstone.
Okay.
He received full military honors. But the story goes on because Kurt, who was 8 years old at the time of Fred's death, remembers his uncle.
Okay.
And so when we got the donations, Kurt and I have since engaged in multiple email chains of, what was your uncle like? Tell me more that doesn't get reported. Those sorts of things.
And, you know, as I pull all those through the views of a 6, 7, 8-year-old boy about his middle-aged uncle, one has to kind of weigh those memories against other things, right? So.
And he loved his uncle.
Yeah.
Kurt, the whole family, what I've realized doing this research, and it's been so great because I've never done research on a person who had living family before. And so all my previous delving into research on people has been either they don't know their descendants or they have no descendants. So to be able to interact with the family as much as I have, it's so nice to know that Fred was so loved, such a big family person. The whole family loves talking about Fred. They love the fact that this article is coming out. They love the idea that there's a potential that his artifacts are going to be in the new exhibit. He was so loved. And so the support that we've gotten, and I say we because it's been the whole historical society, the support we've gotten doing Fred's research and digging into all of this has been enormous.
Excellent. I would say that with Fred taking his own life, of course, this brings up the subject which you don't discuss in the article. And so let's talk about what's not in the article. And I think you and Slater made, although I wasn't a part of the conversation at all, but you guys made excellent editorial choices here. And the term PTSD, which is kind of floating around the whole conversation, you don't discuss that in the article. And I'm wondering if you could share why that is.
So a very early draft of the article did have a whole conversation on shell shock. Okay. And I did a lot of research into this. And we used multiple books. And you loaned me a book by Ben Shepherd.
Yep.
And I did a lot of research into this. And so shell shock is, clinically, it is not a precursor to PTSD. They are two separate things. But a lot of people say that shell shock is a sort of precursor to PTSD, and that a lot of the symptoms are similar. But shell shock is what soldiers in the Civil War, the Spanish-American War, and World War I, and to an extent in World War II, would have experienced post-war, or even during the war in some cases. Mm-hmm. And I had written up this whole section of the article on shell shock and what it was and how it was viewed, which was not positively at the time.
Sure.
And then Slater and I had this discussion about, it is sad Fred took his own life. We cannot diagnose Fred.
Right.
There has never been any discussion about Fred struggling in any way besides one line from his sister, which was, the war changed Fred in ways we cannot understand. And I would say that that line doesn't even prove that Fred had shell shock. It just said that Fred changed, which I think everybody who has participated in a war can say. And so Slater and I decided that putting the shell shock part of that article in there indicates that we believe Fred had it and we can't diagnose him.
Right.
And so we decided to take it out. I will say I do think Fred's experiences during the war did affect him. I don't know. I cannot. I'm not a clinical psychologist. I cannot diagnose him.
Right. And I don't know that even if you were a clinical psychologist, you could diagnose him without examining him yourself.
Right. Right?
I mean, I hear that on, a lot of professionals will say that he's so-and-so is not my patient. I can't say what's going on with him, you know. And so there's a level of responsibility, certainly as historians, to say, well, that's for somebody to, that's for the doctors at, you know, Fort Des Moines, perhaps, to make some type of medical judgment about, and we have no idea what they thought. And so,
shell shock was not an accepted diagnosis. If someone got diagnosed with shell shock, there was a possibility they would be sent to psychiatric care, which was frowned upon at that time.
Sure.
You know, we're talking about a time frame where it was pull yourself up, fix it, and move on. And so even if he was diagnosed, there's a chance we would have never known.
Well, yeah, the history of the medical determination has changed over time since the Civil War. I mean, you kind of ran through the wars, and there's lots of books about this type of thing. And the one you mentioned is by Ben Shepherd, The War of Nerves, which is a book I was read from grad school and had one professor that wanted to get the point across to his students in that class that notions about this kind of thing change. Human body may be pretty remarkably similar for thousands of years, millions of years, but nevertheless, how we categorize certain medical events shifts over time. The interest in or the invention of PTSD, first coming to kind of be a term after Vietnam, kind of locates it as a part of that history and not necessarily something that Fred would or the doctors of his time would recognize. And it's a complicated thing to kind of disentangle all that, particularly right. When you don't have the person in front of you. So
the other book I used was called Soldiers Don't Go Mad, and it's by Charles Glass.
Okay.
It's a pretty newly published book. It came out in 2023. We have a copy if you want it, Ben. The museum does.
Okay.
It talks about British soldiers and how they experienced it. And it goes, it talks about a couple of the soldiers, you know, personally in it. So it was a great insight, but it didn't change the way I looked at Fred at all. You know, from the beginning, I had been told that, hey, Fred died. This does not have a happy ending.
Yeah.
And so we had always known that something happened, but that never changed the way I looked at Fred. It never changed the way I wrote about him. And I think that's really important to highlight.
Well, Corey, just to reiterate, the article is coming out in the fall issue of the South Dakota History Journal, which is a quarterly journal available to members of the South Dakota Historical Society. To be a member, you can go to our website and check that out. And you can, too, become a member. But Corey's work on this, ignited largely by the descendants of within the Lynn family, whom we appreciate a great deal. They've brought their uncle back into our memory and our history, to use a more precise term. And we hope that people can come and read the letters between him and his sister that are going to be housed in the archives. And when the museum reopens, there'll be artifacts there from Fred. So thanks a lot, Corey, for all your hard work on this. Congratulations on the article. And
thank you. Yeah.
See you around.
Yeah. Sounds good to me.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians, or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that,
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.